You tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hi, you're listening to Pineapple Radio on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Atara.
And I'm your other host, Ariel. We are the co-founders of Pineapple Collaborative, an online offline community for women who love food. You may ask us, what does that mean? And we get that a lot. And what we like to share is we're a platform for women to express their style, identity, and values through food. So we host in-person events in DC, New York, San Francisco. We also write really fun digital content called Pine 4 Pantry and a Pine 4 Guide, which we'll kind of touch on later. And we have a very active social media presence, which you should check out. And last but not least, we're on radio once every other week, where we're in conversation with women we pine for. So I'm very excited to announce that we have in the studio today Abby Fuller, who has become a friend and a woman we have pined for since before we met. We're very grateful to have you in the studio.
Welcome, Abby.
What an honor. And right back at you.
As we'll share later, Abby is an award-winning documentarian. She has filmed a number of episodes on Netflix's show Chef's Table. She has two episodes coming out in the next season, which is so exciting.
Can't wait for that.
They're very incredible women. I don't think we'll be able to share, but...
Just take our word for it.
I don't even know if I was supposed to say woman. But in any case, we can't wait to talk with her about not only her filmmaking experience and her career, but she also moved to the DC area about a year ago to a farm in Virginia that's a regenerative cattle farm. And she's got so much knowledge on what sustainable agriculture looks like and where it should be. So this conversation is going to span film to farm.
Yeah. And we at Pine 4 Abby, we're very excited to get into those topics in just a little bit. But before we do, each week on radio, or every other week on radio, I should say, Ariel and I check in with each other to talk about all of the things we pine for in the world of women and food. So it could be an item that we are stocking in our pantries or our refrigerators. It could be a woman-grown piece of produce that we love. It could be something in our closets or something we're reading. And this is our way to really express our philosophy of Pine 4, which is our idea that celebrating another woman, woman-made product, woman-led organization, or woman-made product can create community. And it really does. It makes us so much more successful when we celebrate each other and really shine a light on all of the great work we're doing. So with that...
Atara, what's your pick?
I'm going first. Okay.
Yeah.
So my pick is something that I've been stocking in my freezer for a number of years now, I think, at least 2 years. It's definitely a staple. It's a product called Swapples. They're frozen waffles, and they're made completely out of yuca root, so there's no like gluten or grain or anything in them. So good. Feels like very, you know... I'm not going to say guilt-free because I don't like that term, but it's a nice way to start the morning. And I love their everything bagel flavor. It's really
so
great.
Good.
Yeah.
And she's based in D.C. She started the company here, right?
Yes. Her name is Rebecca Perez. She's a friend of Pineapple's. She's been coming to our events. And she's based in D.C.
Sweet.
Yeah. What about you?
All right. My pick is the Talbot and Arding Sour Cherry Preserves. It's a cheese shop. It's a cheese shop plus. It's got amazing prepared foods and a bakery in Hudson, New York. I was up there a few weeks ago. Just spent the last month in the Hudson Valley, which was pretty dope. And they are a woman team. I forget their names, but Talbot and Arding.
Do you say sour cherries?
Sour Cherry Preserves.
Yum.
Perfect compliment to your cheese board. So you can have some later.
I'm going to. I'm definitely going to.
Same, Abby. I'll come over.
Delicious.
Yeah. Abby, do you have one that you've just been excited about?
Just something that I love and that I'm eating in my pantry.
Yeah.
I just made a peach pound cake yesterday.
Oh my gosh,
so that doesn't count. That's not some? Like a... No, I didn't.
Just kidding. I didn't mean to put you on this.
No, I actually thought about it and I forgot. But that was originally the plan. I was going to bring some pound cake.
Yeah.
Was that a recipe?
Was a recipe from an Edna Lewis cookbook.
Ah, cool.
Who is an incredible
love her.
Chef and restaurateur and cookbook author.
Icon,
who is actually from Virginia as well. So a lot of kind of her recipes, our garden is based off a lot of the same kind of crops and things that she was growing. So I've been kind of deep in the Edna Lewis game and made that peach pound cake. But I can't think of, maybe let me give me a minute and I'll come up with like a
yeah, sure.
purveyor.
Or you can share it at the end of the show when we ask you again, which we will. But for our listeners, definitely learn more about Edna Lewis. She's really the queen of Southern cuisine. She's such an icon. And I'm definitely going to check out her recipe for peach pound cake now.
Sounds good.
Cool. So today on our show, Arielle mentioned this kind of at the top. I'm going to take you through what we're going to discuss. We are going to talk about what masterful storytelling, world-renowned female chefs, and progressive agriculture all have in common. It's our friend, Abby Fuller, who's here with us today. She's an award-winning documentarian. She's the youngest and only woman director of one of our favorite Netflix shows, Chef's Table. She produced and directed the episode for Chef Anna Ross. That was one of our favorite episodes. You should definitely check it out. She got to explore Anna Ross's kitchen in Slovenia. She got to really dig deep on her history there, and it's a great episode. And now she is continuing to document and produce shows for Netflix, but she's also living on a regenerative cattle farm in Virginia, which we visited, and it's amazing. And through this work, Abby highlights issues in our food system by filming the most highly acclaimed chefs, farmers, and activists who are changing the way we eat.
So welcome.
Hi,
again.
Abby.
That sounds so impressive when you write it.
It
like
is
that.
Impressive.
It is the most impressive. It's truly, I can't wait to dig in. And just before we start, where can folks find your farm? It's anotherperfectday.com.
APDfarm.com.
APDfarm.com.
Check us out.
And then APDfarm on Instagram.
And yes, APDfarm on Instagram. And we're actually doing this Saturday, we're starting to do like monthly or bi-monthly tours because there's been a lot of requests. So we've kind of aggregated that into like, let's choose a weekend a month or every other month. So there will be a tour this Saturday at 4:00. And there's an Eventbrite. I believe you can go to our website and check that out if you want to actually come visit and get a full-on tour.
Great. That's
so
amazing.
Listeners in D.C. and Virginia, definitely, and Maryland too, definitely head on over to the farm this Saturday.
Yeah, it's an amazing visit. It'll totally change your perspective on what a farm can be.
That's our goal.
Awesome. So, you know, I think the episode is we want to get to know you, and we hope that listeners leave with a sense for how can we change the food system with powerful storytelling and, you know, knowing more and caring more about the food that we eat.
Hallelujah.
So first, tell us about yourself. What brought you to the world of food, agriculture, and film?
Yeah, so those are all kind of separate stories when I think about them, but there is kind of a beautiful narrative that they all kind of overlap, and one, you know, leads to the other in my story. And so when I kind of always knew I wanted to be a filmmaker, I was the kid in junior high who ran around with the video camera. And coincidentally, that kid running around in junior high with the video camera was also a bit of a fat kid. So my love of food and my love of filmmaking started very young, but weren't necessarily tied together at that point. And I think that when I emerged into the world of documentary filmmaking out of film school at USC, I realized that there was a way to kind of create a career in the world of television. That was something that was growing at the time. This was I graduated in 2008, which was around the time of the recession. And one of the ways that there was still actually like a flood of work was in these kind of low budget documentary TV shows. And so I remember thinking about, okay, well, if I'm going to pursue that, that route, you know, I want it to be about something that I care about, because I independently had, you know, I had a feature film I was doing that was like a passion project and a labor of love. But I figured if I'm going to be doing something, you know, for income and to pay the bills, I wanted it to at least be something that I enjoyed. And so I thought about that a little deeper, and I realized that my extracurricular activities were all around food. I had a food blog. It was all about trying new restaurants. It was all about cooking at home. It was reading cookbooks. It was indulging in, you know, that treat that I love to like look forward to for the weekend and save up my money and really, you know, indulge in something special or go out of my way to the San Gabriel Valley or, you know, all the way to, you know, a restaurant up in Santa Barbara in wine country or something. And so at that point, I thought, okay, well, let's try to put it out there to the universe and to my contacts that I'd love to figure out a way to kind of combine documentary filmmaking and my passion for food. And that started with a job doing a show for the Cooking Channel. And so I went down to Louisiana, and I did a 8-part series producing a show about people jumping ship and changing their lives and going to culinary school. And that was kind of the first step in what became like a food-focused film career trajectory that eventually led me to Chef's Table.
Awesome. I have a bunch of questions. This is kind of a 2-part question. My first one, though, for you is, for some of our listeners that might not know what happens on a film set, what are the roles of, the many roles of a director?
So, yeah, I think it depends project to project, because in the world that we're in now, where we have streaming content and we have commercial content, and there's so many different ways that storytelling has been kind of manipulated and shared and compartmentalized, and so I think it changes. But in general, the role of the director is really the storyteller. It's the one who's creating the visual language. It's the one who's kind of writing the narrative to some degree in a visual way. It's the one who is guiding the edit. It's really the person who has the vision for what the outcome is going to be. And so you work with your kind of department heads. So whether that's your cinematographer or your editor, or, you know, if you're doing something more narrative, your wardrobe or art department, or depending on the roles on the specific project. And you're the one kind of guiding everyone, of saying like, okay, this is what I want it to feel like. This is what the tone should be. This is how we should think about the story and the intent and the themes. Mm-hmm. So you're working at it at a granular level, but it's really kind of the person with the big picture understanding of what is this supposed to be.
Right. I mean, it's a very big and crucial role, obviously. So what is it like to be a woman director, and why are there so few women directors?
Big, complicated, but excellent question. And, you know, it's exciting to see right now a big kind of what I think is a bit of a paradigm shift happening. You know, knock on wood, I hope that the momentum continues in this direction and it's not just like something where it's reactionary. But I have felt like there's recently more opportunities than there's ever been with programs like Free the Bid, for example, which is a way for women directors who are involved in commercial work to be basically to put a little bit of pressure and create excitement for companies to want to work with women directors, or to be thinking about, okay, have we hired women? Let's look at this. Let's ask ourselves why. And let's consider bringing more women onto our team and see how that works out for us. So there's a lot of, I think, momentum in that women and, you know, and also just diversity in general into the film industry has been something that we've seen. So trying to focus on the positive, I see kind of the upshot is that there's more of this. But historically speaking, I think there's this idea that we say you can't be what you don't see. Mm-hmm. And so right. I think historically when people think about what a director looks like and who they're going to trust their multi-million dollar campaign with from an executive level or advertisement level or studio level or whatever, you know, wherever it's coming from, you know, they generally tend to think like a director looks like in their mind, which is, you know, a white man. Mm-hmm. Because historically that's who have been the majority of directors. So when someone who looks like me or a woman or a person of color kind of enters the room, there's a little bit of like an unconscious bias, I think, that happens. And mm-hmm. I don't think a lot of it's intentional. It's just when it comes time to like make the decision of who you trust doing like what we just said, that huge job of the director and being a leader, having all these important decisions to make and being in charge of a lot of money and essentially being in charge of the success of the end product, the people feel more comfortable with doing something they've seen before rather than taking a chance on something new.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, these are parallels for other industries, right?
Definitely.
And whether it's like the food world and, you know, chef owners or executive chefs, restaurateurs, CEOs, you know, we could kind of paste those in for filmmaking directors. And, you know, I think one of the really exciting things about women becoming or being more in the director's chair than ever before is the stories that you choose to tell and how you tell them. It will be a very different perspective than previously. And I think that's something we've seen in your Chef's Table episode. I feel badly, like, I don't think we like know the rest of your work as much as we do Chef's Table, and we're focusing on this, so like we'll have to rectify that afterwards. But I guess my question for you is, you know, you're with an episode or with a film like not a film, I'm sorry, with a platform like Chef's Table, you truly have the power to make someone's career and like tell their story in a way that I'm sure they didn't even think about. And that's incredible power. And I like get the shivers, like even thinking about, having someone like you tell the story of certain chefs, on that platform. So the question is, what are the issues, themes, and ideas that you promote, through film, when you're storytelling?
That's a really cool thing that you bring up, Ariel. And one of the reasons why, you know, I think I for so long wanted to be a filmmaker is there, and specifically documentary, like why I pursued documentary in such a way instead of narrative is I think because of that power or the ability to kind of look at, like, come into somebody's world who you've never met before and help them craft the narrative of the story to share with the world. And that is a really, like, I love that process more than anything else. Mm. That's, like, what I get up in the morning and, like, get most excited about when I'm working on something. And so remind me again what the question was.
Yeah, so the question is, like, you know, what are the issues, themes, and ideas that you want to promote through your filmmaking?
The way that I talk about it, like at least in my inner dialogue in terms of what I'm putting out there, is I want to consistently be doing meaningful work. And that's a pretty vague and ambiguous term, but it's kind of the things that align with my own interests, passions, and, you know, the kind of impact I want to have on the world, because I do recognize that, storytelling is a super powerful thing. And when you look at the ability to kind of create a movement or get people to think about something differently, you know, storytelling is a way that our brains can consume information and remember it and think about different paradigms and, mm-hmm. and create belief systems and remember things. So I think that I've been consistently drawn towards work that I feel like has an important meaning, and that's been a lot of different, you know, I think one of the first films that I worked on outside of school was about like a Tibetan activism film, and I obviously have like done a lot of things in the food space. My feature film is about blind teenagers, and it's about education and advocacy within the education system for disabled teenagers. So it's kind of like project to project. It's like if it pulls at your heart and you realize that it can make a difference or there's something inspiring about it, that's generally, you know, what I'm drawn to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And speaking of episodes or films or projects that really tug at your heartstrings, I think the Honor Us episode of Chef's Table is something that made a very big impact on both me and Ariel. You know, for all of you who may not have seen it, I highly encourage you to check it out. But the story of Anna Ross is really incredible, that she was untrained and, you know, self-taught and created this, you know, really one-of-a-kind destination in Slovenia. It's an incredible story. So what was it like visiting her, being with her, spending time with her, and what did you learn from her?
Yeah, that was an incredible experience. I think it comes through in the film itself. And Anna and I had like a great kind of like just chemistry right away, a great rapport. And I remember I arrived a few days before the rest of the crew because I wanted to scout and get to know her and get to understand Slovenia a little bit more if I was going to be tasked with telling the story of this place. And so I showed up alone, rented a car, and drove through these tiny little streets in the mountains and villages, and finally like settled upon this magical destination. And I kind of knew that was going to, the opening of the film was going to be something that mirrored that experience of like somebody's first ability to enter into this kind of like magical place that most people have never been, and a lot of people have never even heard of. So you know, Anna and Walter were so welcoming and down to earth. And what struck me about her right away is just there was that special something that she has where she doesn't have to work. Like she's an extremely hard worker, but the masterfulness of her artistry and her food comes to her not from hard work. Mm. It comes from her when she's like on a hike or on a walk.
Wow.
Or she would have a big wedding she was catering or a special dinner for the president of the country happening. And she wouldn't know what the menu was going to be yet. But it would come to her like in an instant. Something would, you know, she'd smell a piece of you know, wild mint, and then she'd have an idea for a whole menu. And so seeing that was something that was like incredibly inspiring. And then kind of understanding that here's a woman who had kind of the whole world at her fingertips in terms of what she felt was from her parents and from society, and somebody who is intelligent and got good grades, like what should be her path, and her bravery to say, you know, at the age that she was, which was about, you know, 29 or 30, I'm just going to abandon everything that I've known so far and pursue this crazy wild dream, is a message that I thought was incredibly powerful, inspiring. So it was, for me, it was, I want to say easy, but like, I was so naturally drawn to her and to the narrative and to the story and to the world and to the food on so many levels that it was really like a joyous experience to you know, film the episode and then to put it together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you feel it, yeah. Watching it. And
definitely.
the nuanced, inspiring view of her, I think is very welcome as a woman watching it. It's like, you know, she's totally like that bravery piece, which you mentioned, that was like my biggest takeaway from that episode. It was like, you know, she isn't afraid to like dream and go after it. And like, despite all that people wanted her to do, and she probably wanted to do herself, and the amount that she's like contributed to the food world at large is incredible. And Chef's Table helped show people who haven't been to Slovenia that her impact is growing by the day.
I think you mentioned, Abby, to us once that she really contributed to this like boon of tourism to Slovenia, right?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, before, just to put it into perspective, before I went to Slovenia, I was trying to do research on Anna, and I couldn't find anything on the internet in English.
Wow.
About her. And now, you know, she's the Hisha Franco is number 48 restaurant in the world.
Amazing.
And she's obviously been, if you Google, you'll find lots of things. You'll find lots of things in English. And her story has been retold so many times. And so it's like quite an honor to be the one to have like kind of broken that story and have people felt something and wanting to continue to tell it. And also for, you know, it also, everything that has happened to her has been deserved. So I feel like this is just kind of was like, hey guys, look what's happening over here. It's mm-hmm. really worth taking notice of. And she's kind of risen to every occasion.
Do you maintain a relationship with her?
She's so busy, that it's not as like in depth as, you know, but I actually went back with Matt, and she was traveling, but I spent time with her parents and her kids, and we've exchanged emails every once in a while, but would love to go back and just get to hang out sometime. The correspondences are brief, but always filled with lots of love mm-hmm. when we do connect. And so I feel like it's one of those things that it's not going to kind of go away. Like when we see each other again, it will be pretty kind of like instant from where we left off.
It's amazing. Well, I'm very excited for the episodes to come for the next season. Is it season 5?
Yeah. So the pastry season is now... That is considered season 4. So the two episodes that I have that I've already filmed, one is completely finished, and they just announced the air date, which will be September 28th.
Mark that on your calendar.
Yes, mark that down, everybody.
And then I just finished filming another episode just a couple weeks ago. I just got back 2 weeks ago. And... that one it reminded me of the kind of like magnetic, exciting energy, positivity that I had in Slovenia. So this one I'm also really excited about. We start editing it in another week or two. So that one will come out next spring, I think.
Can't wait. Seriously. Great. Well, we are here with Abby Fuller, our friend, a filmmaker and a storyteller. We will be back in just a minute to talk about regenerative agriculture and her move to Virginia. Stay with us.
We'll be right back.
Hi there. Welcome back to Pineapple Radio. I am one of your hosts, Atara. We are sitting here with one of our friends, Abby Fuller, who is the only female director of Chef's Table. She's a filmmaker at large. She's a storyteller. She's a good friend of ours. And we just spent a few minutes talking to her about her film career and what brought her there. So, Abby, we know because we are friends with you, but we're excited to share this, that about a year ago, you moved to a regenerative farm in Virginia, which was, you know, definitely a very different environment from living in LA making films. So what kind of brought you to that chapter?
So based on what we were just talking about with Anna, you know, I think it's important to mention that a lot of that experience of going to Slovenia, I think in retrospect, planted a seed of the type of life that I wanted to live. We mentioned how Anna, like, had the bravery and the audacity to kind of like make a left turn and try something new, that she was inspired by love to make a great change. And also, I think spending about a month in Slovenia, you know, I really kind of recognized how much I do love being out in nature and kind of was inspired by the story that I was telling, the story that she was living. And so that was a very, that was in 2015. And, you know, a year later was when I met Matt, who is my fiance, and he is a farmer. And he kind of swept me off my feet and introduced me to this beautiful world he had been creating in rural Virginia, which is on a 1,500-acre farm. Regenerative operation, grazing operation. And I think that, you know, that idea to me, I think, was something that I wasn't scared about making a move out to rural Virginia, where I think a lot of my girlfriends said, oh my God, you know, you're someone who's only lived in New York City and LA for the past 14 years. Like, what are you going to do? I now live in a town of 200 people. So as that relationship got serious and we were doing long distance, and I kind of thought, you know, do I want to make this big life change? It was pretty easy. It was a pretty easy yes, to be out, connected to another story about food and to be living that story myself. And I think that there's also a natural progression of somebody who was incredibly passionate about flavor, about food, about chefs, about restaurants, and knew kind of in a very like tangential and like surface level way about where food came from, that for me the natural step was to know more about that. I think it was Wendell Berry, and I'm going to mess up his quote, but really talks about, you know, loving food as and not being not understanding where it comes from is like a total contradiction. Mm-hmm. And so that to me was something that I was naturally fascinated in, and moving out to the farm gave me the pathway to a deeper understanding and connection to that.
That's beautiful. I think we at Pineapple have also, you know, our company is rooted in a reverence for food, and this idea of like revering food as well as then revering agriculture and the people who grew it, picked it, you know, produced it, the land from which it comes, and just like the overall context of your food that needs to be part of one's reverence for food. So we're on that train with you. And, you know, I think for a lot of folks who are listening, they're potentially not aware of what regenerative agriculture is. And specifically, what is a regenerative grazing operation? Can you touch on that?
Yeah, so I think that one of the important kind of distinguishments to make is that, you know, agriculture, regenerative agriculture, the way that we're managing our operation is the effort is that it looks more like nature than it does agriculture. So when we think about agriculture, pretty much all agriculture is pretty devastating to our soils and our environment through tilling, through killing biological matter in the soil, through reducing habitat for wildlife. And this has been a story that's like not what's happened in the past 20 years or 100 years, but what's happened like in the past 10,000 years. So what we're doing on our farm is grazing livestock, cattle in our case, to mimic the wild herbivore populations that existed on this land and co-evolved with all of the vegetation that's on our land. So we use electrical fence in place of the predators that would have pursued these herbivore herds. And we move them along like multiple times a day in high stock density, which means lots of animals in a small space. And this is what allows the vegetation to basically experience the evolutionary blueprint of how they came to be, which is co-evolving with saliva and enzymes from the mouth, the footprints of the hoof, their hooves on the ground, the dung and the urination and the nutrients that come from that fertilization, and then rest period, which is moving the animals off the land to a new piece of grass, and then letting that kind of cocktail of nutrients and moisture be hit by the sun, create photosynthesis, and that's how the carbon cycle works. So it's hard to give the top line of this because it can be a little complex, but essentially, you know, in a nutshell, it's agriculture that mimics nature as much as possible, and that's how we bring back biodiversity. And by bringing back biodiversity, that's how we cycle carbon.
Yeah, it's all very fascinating and, like you said, complex. But you know, I would say most people think that, you know, there is this narrative that eating meat is bad for the environment. So can you talk about why that is not the case and how eating meat from a regenerative farm that focuses on soil could actually help combat climate change?
Yeah, I think if you break down why we think eating meat is bad for the environment, that comes down to one, growing grain to feed grain-fed animals. So large swaths of monocultures in the Midwest, transportation and fossil fuels and moving around grain and moving around cattle. And then you have feedlots, which are, you know, just destructive to the environment because none of those nutrients that we talked about are being put into the ground. They're being put in these like toxic waste piles that are hazardous. So you have unhealthy animals and you have unhealthy soils and you have monocultures and you have fossil fuels. That's bad. What's not a part of that conversation as an alternative to vegetarianism and grain-fed is grass-fed and finished regenerative animals. And those are the animals that are actually doing us a huge service by mimicking nature, mimicking the wild. You know, when in 1491, before European settlers came to North America, there were 70 million bison migrating from Canada down to Mexico. And so, you know, and that was just a remnant population of all the millions of animals that inhabited our earth for millions of years. And so most of the interesting thing is those animals are gone. Like, I don't know, last time you saw a bison migrating through the DMV area.
Adams Morgan. Not recently.
You know, you go down. I did a road trip recently. And it's like you don't see one animal. Animals aren't there are no animals around. And if they are, they are livestock. And so that's why we have to kind of use the livestock to mimic the work that those wild herbivore populations were doing. And the vegetation, so all the grasses, all these perennial plants that co-evolved with all of these herbivore populations, those are still the same. They haven't evolved out of that to understand, okay, there's going to be nothing, there's going to be no animals to graze me anymore. There's going to be, so as, you know, if there's no way for that biological matter to decay properly, like inside the stomach of a ruminant, then it turns to desert or the plants die. And then carbon doesn't cycle. So it's something that I feel like is one of those experiences where we have this context where we think about our food systems in how they exist in 2018. And if we're looking back to understand how they've changed, maybe we're looking to like the 1950s or maybe even at the turn of the century, but we're not looking back far enough to understand what the earth needs. We're in such a specific time that we're not looking at the evolutionary processes that our land needs to, in order to function.
Yeah, it's a whole new way of thinking about our food system. And I think I've learned so much from you and Matt about meat in terms of like eating our values. And one thing I want to touch on before we have to wrap up, sadly, is your focus on soil. And I think as much as you're thinking about the cattle and their flavor, you know, from a food perspective, you know, that starts with really healthy soils. And as some of you know, I just spent about a month at Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture in Pocantico Hills, New York, where they're all about the concept of agroecology. And, you know, rather than agriculture, as Abby was saying, how can we make our food system look more like nature? So that gets me to this idea, which I think we all need to think more about, which is healthy soils should be really like our North Star when it comes to creating a better food system. So with that question, can you talk to us about your point of view on soil and the importance of healthy soil specifically for, you know, not only a great, for a better planet, but like delicious food, because I want to make the connection between healthy soils and delicious food.
Absolutely. And I think when we first walked in here before we started recording, we're like, yeah, we want to like make soil sexy.
Yeah.
So, you know, yes. Hashtag sexy soil,
yep,
is the takeaway here. And, you know, if you listen to this and there's one thing to walk away with, it's that we should be thinking about soil, period. And I don't think that often enters into the conversation or people even know where to begin, because so many of us live in urban environments where we're not interacting with soil. We're not growing our own food. And when you have to do that, which is how you know, probably our grandparents or grandparents existed, like you kind of naturally had to understand a little bit of that. But as we've gotten further away from our connection to the land on an individual basis, we've gotten further away from that important narrative. And that's one of the things that Edna Lewis writes a lot about too, is just the soils. And she doesn't write about it in terms of, hey, you know, this is like an issue that we should care about in an agenda or a policy thing. She just, it was common knowledge. You know, you have to keep the soils healthy, and you have to create the cover crops, and you have to do this if you want to grow that, you know, her book, In Pursuit of Flavor, if you want to grow flavorful, delicious food. Mm-hmm. There is definitely a link. And, you know, the work that's being done at Stone Barns, I think, is like an incredible, one of the leaders in kind of making that connection and thinking about that connection and the communication of that. And we sell our beef to Dan Barber at Blue Hill at Stone Barns, and they're friends and collaborators of ours. And we're looking at grazing some of their cattle actually here over the winter when it's colder in New York. But essentially, like, to kind of like simplify as much as possible, is that soil that's alive, where there's lots of microbes, there's lots of life, creates the ability for minerals and all of the things that kind of give flavor to enter into the uptake of the plant, which then is eaten by the cow or is then turned into produce if you're growing food. And so if we have soil that's devoid of life, and that happens through pesticides and herbicides and tilling and all the things that happens in these most conventional agriculture, we're killing the soil and therefore killing the flavor. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about, like, if you've had at some great farm-to-table restaurant or somewhere like Stone Barns, where you're like, wow, how does this tomato taste like that? Or why does this, like, this kale tastes like each bite has packed with flavor and leafy and rich. And it's because the soil's alive, and it's because the minerals in the soil are able to kind of enter into that plant. And that's what creates flavor. And so as we're continuing to degrade our soils, and as we're continuing to, you know, with each of these crazy rainstorms like we're getting, see soil runoff and erosion, and getting washing into the rivers, you know, we're losing the ability to grow food, period.
Right.
But we're definitely losing the ability to grow healthy food. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that, you know, if you talk to your grandparents or grandparents and you say, you know, what did an apple taste like for you growing up? Or what did that tomato taste like? I bet you they are going to say it tastes different than it tastes now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because we're not growing food in biologically alive, healthy, rich soils.
Wow. We're going to have a totally separate Pineapple Radio episode all about soil.
Yeah, so stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Abby, you'll be hopefully back in the studio joining us.
Yeah.
Can't wait. Hashtag sexy soil.
Yeah. Hashtag pine for soil.
Yes.
There you go. Pine for soil.
So Abby, I mean, it's really such an honor to know you, have you in our corner, and learn all about the work that you and Matt are doing on the farm. We have a lot of listeners who really care about our food, where it comes from. What would you say to a pineapple woman or a listener who wants to engage with her environment and her food system and wants to support operations like yours? What are some things that consumers can do to make a difference?
Yeah, I think it's complicated and hard and, to be tasked. You know, we understand that our voting dollars can do a lot. We know that the issues that we care about, you know, if enough people care, we can make moves. What's challenging is knowing, you know, the practices that each farm has. And most of us on kind of, you know, a day-to-day basis at the restaurant or at the grocery store, it's getting that information it's not on the label.
Right.
And there's people like Aria doing, who's a mutual friend of Ariel and I, doing great work of trying to create policy changes and create labeling systems so that we can know that information. But I would say that right now it's kind of understanding and knowing, you know, if you go to a farmer's market, there's a better chance that you can have a conversation with someone versus going to the grocery store. So that's always a great way to start. And if you identify the people that are using livestock or holistically managing, that's a great term if you remember that one. Those are definitely the people that you should be buying from. There are great restaurants like The Perennial in San Francisco and Cafe Gratitude in LA and places that are like taking on this mission and living and breathing it and walking the walk. But unfortunately, those are few and far between. They're prioritizing regenerative agriculture. But I do love the term regenitarian, which was something that Sally Calhoun, who's a big leader out in California at Piscinas Ranch, mentioned to me. And that has always stuck with me because I think that for those people that are saying, well, I'm going to be a vegetarian because of environmental reasons, or I'm going to choose a different food path or way that I consume, that's kind of like the way to think about it is like, well, let me think about the ecological roots of where this food came from. And it can be incredibly overwhelming to try to live a life like that in an urban setting.
Yeah.
But whatever steps we can take to understand a little bit more and know the products and know the farmers that are employing it, and when you can buy from them, mm-hmm. or support their businesses or visit their farms, I think those are great steps in the right direction.
Totally. Eat like a regenitarian. I like that.
Yeah, I think we, if we can all talk about it more with our friends, our family,
our farmers,
and even, you know, I think going to the grocery store and talking to your meat counter and say, hey, like, I want grass-fed and finished meat. I want it to, you know, be from a local producer, and, you know, if you want it, like, they might supply it.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because we actually had a little bit of a summit yesterday that we were convening with our team about, you know, basically the marketing side of our business. And unfortunately, most of our product is going into New York City, mm-hmm. because actually that's where the demand is, mm-hmm. for grass-fed and finished. And we want to be here in DC, and I think it's going to start with what we want to do is ask chefs and ask restaurants and ask people to say, like, I really would love a grass finished product, mm-hmm. to buy. And if they don't have it, we want to say, raise our hands and say, we're here. You can buy it from us. But right, without the demand, we can't be in the food supply in a meaningful way in DC.
Totally. And I think that's a key distinction. It should be grass fed and finished, because a lot of grass fed meat is grain finished and
grain finished. And that's like, so they, you know, the USDA doesn't actually have any regulatory guidelines for grass-fed. And that's, again, a whole other thing. But that's basically, like, there's so much, as we know, which goes across many industries, but the idea of greenwashing.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that out there that you need to be careful for. And actually, some of the worst, you know, offenders are the ones who are saying the best things about their products. So I think it's, you know, be careful. Grass finished is the term that you want to look for.
Before we head into our Spitfire round, can you tell us what grass finished means?
Grass finished means that the steer or the cow, the cattle, never consumed any grain during its lifetime. That means that through its entire lifetime, it was eating grass. We don't know if it was managed holistically, but there's a better chance that it was. And we know, you know, ruminants didn't evolve to eat grain. That's something we do to fatten them quickly for our industrial food system. So if it's finished on grass, that means that it ate grass in its entire life, which is how it should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. So just have a critical eye when you're consuming anything. Ask questions.
Yeah.
And that is your prerogative. Awesome. All right. Well, like I said, so many more questions about soil, which I hope we can get into at another point in time.
Nerding out session.
Exactly. But we want to wrap this up with our Spitfire round of questions, which is a Pineapple Radio classic. And we want to get to know your style, identity, and values around food that we haven't already touched on. So who is a woman you pine for in food?
So I think because I just mentioned Sally Calhoun, she comes to mind, and she's just really badass, because she's someone who was a software engineer, sold her company for I don't know how much, but lots and lots of money, and decided that she wanted, okay, I'm going to basically retire. What do I do now? And decided that she wanted to focus on climate change. And through kind of the, you know, a circuitous path, she arrived at soils, and then she arrived at cattle. So now she has a 7,000 acre ranch that provides grass-fed beef in the Central Valley of California, right outside Silicon Valley. So she's just one of these people who now speaks on lots of panels and gives grants and does great work in this field.
Awesome. Check out Sally Calhoun and all the work she's doing. All right. Our next question, your go-to pantry and fridge item. So two items, one in the pantry, one in the fridge.
Oh my gosh. So many. Raw cream in the fridge. Gotta have it in my coffee every morning.
Yum.
And of course it's grass grazed.
Obviously.
we buy it from, we have some farmer friends that are, do the Nults, if that, some people I think they kind of supply here sometimes, but in DC. Amazing raw cream. Mm. And in the pantry, man, recently, I mean, gotta love a brioche bun because on a cattle farm we're eating a lot of burgers.
Mm-hmm. Yum.
Perfect companion.
Or when after our jarring party, Labor Day weekend, put that also on your calendars, girls.
Yeah. Jotting it down.
Would be, you know, jarred tomatoes from the garden.
Mm. Set you up for the fall and winter seasons.
Exactly.
Perfect.
Your all-time favorite documentary.
Oh my gosh. There's so many. That's a really hard to kind of pick a definitive one, but I will say, because I was just having a conversation about it earlier today, if you haven't seen Chasing Coral in our climate change related conversation today, that's definitely one that moved me and I feel like everyone should watch.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And that's a Netflix documentary, Chasing Coral?
I'm not exact. I believe it's on Netflix. Cool. I'm not exactly sure. I think.
Our producer is saying yes, it is.
Thank you.
So check it out on Netflix. And for our last question, Abby, where can our audience find you and Another Perfect Day and Another Perfect Day meet? So it can be online or offline.
Yeah. So let us know. We can ship you. Meet. You know, it's always more economical to find some friends and go in on a share if you have a chest freezer, if you're willing to buy one to get like a half or a quarter.
Do you do shares?
We do shares.
And just to explain what that means.
So if you buy, if you buy a ribeye steak, it's going to be a higher cost per pound versus if you say, I want to buy a whole quarter of an animal and I'm going to, share that with some friends, because as you know, the steaks are the first thing to go, and then you have roast and you have all these kind of other parts that end up not being sold and eaten. So this eliminates waste because we use the whole animal. So it would be, you know, a reduced price for if you do like an eighth or a quarter or a half of an animal. So we will sell shares. And
is there
a
link for that on your website to like sign up for a share?
At this point, just email us.
Okay.
It would be the info@APD Farm.
Great.
If you're interested, and we can probably connect certain people looking for shares. And that's probably the best way. Come to the farm or let us know and we can ship you something.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much again for joining us. And we have an event tonight with Abby, which we're super excited about.
And follow along on stories if you are not going to be there tonight.
Yeah, on Pineapple Collaborative Stories. So on Instagram, we're @PineappleCollaborative. And speaking of which, if you have any feedback or questions on this episode, shoot us an email, hello@pineapplecollaborative.com, or send us a DM on Instagram. Really anywhere you want to reach us, we'll listen and write back.
And hey, if you like Pineapple Radio, if you like this episode, please rate us on your podcast app. We will give you a shout out if you do. So do it if you like it.
Yep. Yeah. and if you have any suggestions for women we should feature, topics you want us to cover, again, we're all ears. So hit us up. Thank you again for listening and tuning in every other week. And we'll see you again soon.